My name is Catherine Tinkham from the University of Toronto, and today we're going to be talking about one of the most important measurements that you can make in any solid organ transplant recipient, the CPRA. The CPRA, or calculated panel reactive antibody, is first and foremost an estimate of access to transplantation, where access is defined by an acceptably HLA mismatched donor. We also use the CPRA to identify patients who have elevated HLA antibodies and may require different programs to access donors, as well as using the same technology to identify the actual antibodies that a patient has, so we can use this in virtual cross-matching. And then finally, we use the CPRA as a way of informing our patients and care providers what their access is and using this to help them better understand the process to transplantation. We also use CPRA to inform our actions. We can use this information to help drive new allocation strategies in order to get patients better access to transplant. So why do we measure CPRA? Many of our patients have had prior exposure to blood transfusion, prior transplant, or pregnancy. And any one of these exposures to foreign HLA antigens can lead to the production of antibodies. But not all patients form antibodies. Between 10 to 70% of patients who've been exposed to one or more of these sensitizing events will make an HLA antibody. And this 10 to 74% of patients can make antibodies to one or many HLA antigens. What does this mean for their access to transplant? Well, if we consider the pool of potential donors, it becomes really important for us to know, do they have antibody to a few donors? Do they have antibody to half the donors? Or do they have antibody to this half of donors? So not only what percentage of donors in the population that someone might have antibody to, but also what are the HLA types of those donors to whom they have antibody? So how do we start to sort through this? Well, the main technology used in calculating CPRA is the single antigen bead technology. This is where HLA antigens are covalently bound to microspheres, where each microsphere has just a single HLA antigen on it. These single antigen beads are mixed with the patient's serum that may or may not have HLA antibodies in it. However, if some of these antibodies are specific for the beads in the serum, the antibodies will bind. When these antibodies bind, we add a secondary fluorescent detector antibody. And in that circumstance, if there's an antibody on the cell bound to the single antigen, it can then be detected by this fluorescent antibody. We run these beads through either a flow cytometer or a Luminex instrument, which is really just a type of specialized flow cytometer, and we get an output that we compare to a negative control. So if our negative control fluorescence is here, a bead that has antibody bound might have a fluorescence here, whereas a bead that has no antibody bound might have a fluorescence in this range. And this difference in fluorescence between the negative control is normalized over all of the beads with that particular antigen on it in the reaction, and we get a readout called a mean fluorescence intensity. This mean fluorescence intensity is an estimate, and only an estimate, of the amount of antibody that is in the patient's serum specific to that bead. Why is it only an estimate? Imagine, if you will, an ideal bead that has a standard amount of antigen on it that binds all the antibodies in the serum in a perfectly one-to-one ratio where those antibodies are present and is able to generate a predictable MFI. We'll call that our MFI baseline. But now I'm going to tell you that not all the beads in the reaction have the same density of antigen. This is because these antigens are bulky, awkward molecules with different charges that may or may not fit on the surface of the beads in the same way. And because of that, some of the beads will have less antigen than others and some will have more. And you can appreciate that in a setting of a saturating amount of antibody, where there's less antigen present, as we have in this case, fewer antibodies are going to be able to bind because there's fewer antigens to bind to. And in this case, the MFI will be lower than what you would expect for the corresponding same amount of antibody. We also can have circumstances where there can be substances in the serum that actually block the antibody binding. So the antibody may be specific to this particular bead, but because of the substances in the serum, the antibody can't get to its target antigen, and we don't detect it with the fluorescent antibody. Commonly called the prozone effect, if we're not aware of it, we're not seeking it, and we're not treating the serum to get rid of it, this will also give you a much lower MFI than you would otherwise expect for the same amount of antibody. And then finally, and probably most importantly, HLA molecules are actually, despite their heterogeneity in the population, have many similarities to each other at the epitope level within the molecule. And remembering that antibodies don't bind to antigens, they bind to epitopes within those molecules, we can appreciate that there's many different groups of beads in our single antigen bead reagents where the antibodies can bind to epitopes that are shared amongst beads. So I've given you an example here. A2, 23, 24, 68, and 69 actually share a large number of epitopes between these different HLA antigens that are presented on different beads. So even though I might have a fixed amount of antibody in my serum, if the antibody happens to be against an epitope on A2, but it's also one of those epitopes that's shared amongst all of these beads, this antibody can actually get diluted out across all of the beads in the reaction. But if you're only interested in, let's say, one of these, an A68, and you look at the MFI of just the A68 bead in this circumstance, you will think there is less or lower MFI because the antibody diluted across this pattern won't be immediately obvious unless you're aware of these epitope shares. So again, it's really important to remember that the MFI is an output of an assay, but it is only one variable in how we determine whether or not an antibody is present and what strength it is. So when I ask the question, what's the relationship of MFI to titer? What I can say unequivocally is that MFI is not equal to titer. It is not equal to an amount. It is the output of the assay that helps us estimate the amount of antibody, but it's only one factor amongst others that we use in determining where we put our cutoff for any given patient. We also use the epitope analysis, as I've suggested there. We use the patient history. What is their sensitizing event? What were they sensitized with? How recently did it happen? And we also look at multiple trends over time, beads going up and down, beads moving up in the reaction pattern, to help us understand what is and is not real for a given patient. It's really important to know that there is no standard cutoff that can be applied between institutions or even between patients within the same institution, because there's so much more that goes into deciding what antibody is acceptable, including the patient's own tolerance for immunologic risk. Nonetheless, assuming we can get a cutoff and you work with your laboratory to determine what is the right type of approach for your patient, where you put that cutoff will dramatically change your CPRA. The output that we get, stylistically, looks very much like this. We have a graph where the MFI is on the vertical axis, and each one of these lines represents the fluorescence on every one of the beads in the single antigen bead assay, and there can be up to 100 beads tested for each of class 1 and class 2. And you can appreciate that if you decide you're going to put a patient's cutoff, let's say here, and these are the beads that are going to be positive, you might capture these. You might say these are going to be my unacceptable antigens used in the CPRA. But if in consultation with your laboratory, the cutoff goes down here, now you've got a whole lot more beads. Maybe you're getting these as well. And so where you put your cutoff will dramatically impact your list of unacceptable antigens. This cutoff should absolutely be determined in clinical pathologic consultation with the HLA laboratory and really be almost an individualized patient decision. Once you've made your determination of what antibodies are going to be included in your unacceptable antigen list, we have our list of antibodies. But we have to turn this into something meaningful. What does this mean when I'm comparing it to my donor population? Well, in order to understand that, I need to use a CPRA calculator. And a CPRA calculator uses HLA antibodies, but it also uses multiple loci across A, B, C, D, R, etc. And it includes all the typing from a particular donor population of interest. And this is particularly important. You want to be calculating your CPRA from the donor population that you're actually transplanting from for it to be most meaningful. So when you use a CPRA calculator and I plug these numbers in, using two commonly available calculators right now, I can get two different answers. I can get 75 if I put it in the UNOS calculator, or I can get 99% if I put it in the Canadian calculator. Why these differences? Is it because the donor populations are different? Maybe. I can tell you in this case, that's not the case. It's actually because the loci that are included in the calculator are different. DQ alpha is included in the Canadian population calculator, as is DP alpha beta. And these are not presently included in the UNOS calculator. So you can see for certain patients that are potentially very highly sensitized, if you are interested in avoiding DP antibody or DQ alpha antibody at transplant, that you might be underestimating their CPRA, where these loci are not included in your calculator. And this is also particularly important when we consider other populations around the world. HLA type is very, very strongly linked to your ethnic basis, to your race. And when we look in other populations in the world, in India and in Asia, the CPRA calculations that we make in a North American population are going to be close to, but not really exact, when we look at what the CPRA calculation would be using a population that represents their donor pool's race. So I think as we think about CPRA, remember your antibodies, the loci you include, and the HLA type specific to the population that you are interested in as the main determinants of how your CPRA is calculated. So now I've got a number. What does that mean for my patient? So I've got a series of numbers. I have a patient with a PRA of 20%. I have a patient with a PRA of 50%, a CPRA of 95%, 98%, 99%, and 100%. What does this mean for these patients? Well, a PRA of 20% means you have DSA, at least one DSA, or donor-specific antibody, to 20% of the randomly selected population, 80% not. So your chances are four out of every five donors are still going to be fine for you. You have good access to transplant. Even at 50%, still one out of every two donors will have an acceptable HLA profile, allowing you to avoid donor-specific antibody. It starts to get trickier around 95. At this stage, only one out of every 20 donors that otherwise would be an ABO match, or in the case of thoracic organs, an appropriate size match, only one out of every 20 of those donors statistically would be expected to be an acceptable HLA match for you. At 98, it becomes one out of 50. At 99, it becomes one out of 100. And at 100%, does it really become zero? What do these actually mean? So when we think about the CPRA, it's rounded to the closest integer. But you can appreciate that someone could be 99.0% and be classified as a 99% CPRA, or 99.4%. And this individual has access to about one in every 160 donors. But they're both called 99%. And it gets even more interesting when you start to split up the 100s. So a 99.5% will round up to 100, right? And we can appreciate that's one out of every 200 donors. And a 99.9% is one out of 1,000. So as we get higher and higher in our CPRA calculation, understanding the nuance of where your patients, your highly sensitized patients, place on this scale really starts to give you some important information for discussing likelihood of transplantation and how long people might wait. How do you turn this into how long people might wait? It depends on your absolute number of donors in your region. So if you are in a region that has 100 deceased donors a year that is available to this patient, and your patient has a PRA of truly 99.0, you would say, well, if 100 deceased donors of appropriate blood type come in, I might expect this patient to wait up to a year. But if you're in a region that only has 30 deceased donors per year, that number now triples to 3 years wait time. So the way you translate this into access is really related to the absolute number of donors in the region that the patient has access to. And this is why it's so important for these highly sensitized patients. The most important treatment we have for them is not a drug, it's not an immunosuppression, it's access to more donors. Because if I can increase their donor pool to 1,000 or 2,000 or 5,000, this 1 in 1,000 number doesn't look quite so daunting anymore. And that's really the premise of all of the national access programs that give these highly sensitized patients access to national and regional pools of donors beyond their own local area. And that's CPRA in a nutshell. We use CPRA to inform ourselves of which patients have high levels of antibodies so that we can action that by exposing them to greater numbers of donors to increase their chance of having equitable access to transplantation. Thank you very much.